Welcome. When I was writing my PhD at University College London, I had lunch with a fellow called Vic. Vic, who worked in the electronics business, was kind enough to inquire about the subject of my thesis. After I'd treated him to a shortened version of my fascination with Greek burial customs, Vic turned a winning smile on me and asked playfully, "So what?" The so what question is always with me, and it's one that I want to try to answer in this lecture. Answer number one, culture is a composite structure. The connections between the Greeks and the Romans, between Greek and Roman society, culture, and politics, have, I believe, much to tell us in our multicultural society about the way in which culture is created. They remind us all the time that culture is not something that is created and owned by one people alone, but one that draws from and is enriched by the contributions of others. The second answer to the so what question has to do with close and abiding relations between any two peoples. I'm reminded, for example, of the close and abiding ties that exist between the Americans and the Brits. Two peoples who historically, culturally, and politically see eye to eye on a lot of things, even though there are, from time to time, inevitable strains in the special relationship. It's the closest analogy that I can think of, but it doesn't even come close, because the Greeks and the Romans were so bound up with one another. With that in mind, a different kind of analogy that we might consider is that of a marriage, one that experiences many ups and downs, as do all human relationships. I'm not being cynical, but there was a trajectory to the political involvement between the Greeks and Romans that resembled the course of many marriages. Number one, the marriage began with a honeymoon period, down to Flamininus's declaration of independence at the Isthmian Games in 196 BC. There followed, number two, a virtual breakdown leading to the destruction of Corinth in 146 BC. There then occurred, number three, a gradual recovery and patching up of old differences over time, say from the first century BC onwards, leading to, four, a harmonious mutual acceptance of one another in later life, beginning in the reign of Augustus. And then, finally, number five, a physical dissolution when one of the parties to the marriage passes away, though the other one goes on living to a very ripe old age. After all, the Byzantine Empire went on for another 1,000 years. The truth, however, is that there were many more twists and turns to their relationship than that. But the analogy is, I think, useful as an expression of the complexity, mutability, and longevity of this unique relationship. The third answer is that we get to understand what the Greeks and Romans got out of this uniquely close relationship. Not that the Greeks had any chance of suing for divorce, so to speak. So, first, what did the Romans get out of the relationship? A, the Romans profited from Greek professional expertise in a whole host of areas. It is a phenomenon that has no exact equivalent in any other society. The Greeks were the physicians, the entertainers, the teachers, and the scientists of the Roman world. The Romans, by and large, left them a free field in all these areas. They essentially admitted that the Greeks were superior. You'll recall the passage in the Aeneid that begins, "Let others," meaning let the Greeks, "practice this, that, and the other, because," the unexpressed thought goes, "we, the Romans, just aren't in the same league." Virgil's statement of national self-definition, as I've called it, also turns out to be an admission of cultural inferiority. Of course, the cultural superiority of the Greeks bred resentment, particularly in the lower orders, who thought of them as greasy social climbers with a talent for doing decent Romans out of work. But the resentment was never enough to make a real difference or to bring about change. B. Hellenism was at the center of what it meant to be an educated and cultivated Roman. You don't need to know anything about British culture, British history, British literature, British art to be an educated American. But as an educated Roman, you absolutely had to be cognizant with Greek culture, Greek history, Greek art, and at least a bit of Greek history. Cognizant isn't quite the word, however. It's too bland. It's almost as if educated Romans had a kind of chip in their brain that enabled them to assume a kind of quasi-Greek identity, culturally speaking. A German scholar called Edvard Frankl put it well. He wrote, "The cultural world in which the mind of an educated Roman moved was composed of a Greek sphere and a Roman sphere. No picture of man's experience was complete unless both spheres were viewed together." Being an educated Roman from the middle of the first century BC onwards meant by definition being familiar with and appreciative of all things Greek. And that meant owning Greek statuary, or what are sometimes copies thereof. 2. Employing a Greek tutor to educate his children. 3. Being versed in Greek literature. 4. Being capable of speaking as well as reading Greek. And if you couldn't check off all of the above, then your social cachet was seriously compromised. And if anything, that became truer in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. Again, an extraordinary abandonment, this time of cultural supremacy on the part of elite Romans. Without the Greek chip in the brain, virtually any Roman was seriously limited, socially speaking, and particularly at the very top of the social tree, namely in the imperial court itself. The third way in which the Romans benefited from contact with the Greeks was by immersing themselves in a venerable and rich tradition. Now, this is related to my second point, but I think it actually goes deeper. Aficionados continued to idolize Greek language and literature and to discover in it something that was lacking in Latin. Without Homer, there would be no Virgil, or at least only a very pale imitation thereof. And Roman architecture, without its Greek predecessor, is inconceivable. The Latin language never came into its own as a literary vehicle until immersion in the Greek language, though Latin never came even close to supplanting Greek as a spoken language. Given the vast number of Greek speakers in the Roman East, that would have been an impossible challenge, perhaps, for any language in a pre-technological era. It's pretty obvious the Romans should have benefited from running an empire. But what about the Greeks? What did they get out of the relationship? Alpha. The Romans provided them with the kinds of facilities and advantages that their civilization brought to every corner of their empire. These advantages, which were available to anyone living under Roman rule, are ironically rattled off by John Cleese in Monty Python's Life of Brian. He's speaking as a Jewish subject living in Judea in the time of Jesus, and he's very bitter against the Romans, hoping to stir up a revolt among the fractured nationalist groups that were indeed a feature of the Jewish opposition in the decades before the Jewish revolt. His character says, "Apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?" Actually, though, the Greeks made first-rate wine. They were the best physicians in the ancient world, and as for education, the Greeks were the teachers of choice. Even so, the observation is not off base regarding how the Greeks fared under Roman rule, in that a certain quality of life, as measured by internal security and the provision of essential services, did prevail throughout the empire at most times and in most places, and the Greeks, like other peoples, would have been the beneficiaries of this, even though One has to set this circumstance against the destruction and loss of life that the Romans caused in the first centuries of their occupation. Roman imperialism was characterized by aggressive expansionism, acquisitive materialism, and an overarching ideology that encouraged and justified both. Well, actually, that's Robert Kagan's description of America, rightly or wrongly, in his book entitled Dangerous Nation, America and the World, 1600 to 1900. But it certainly applies to Rome. So in material terms, what the Romans gave the Greeks was a mixed bag. Beta. The Romans provided an appreciative context in which Greek culture could flourish and continue to develop. And that was a very big gift indeed. If the Romans had not appreciated, imitated, adapted, reinterpreted, and preserved Greek culture, we would know very much less about the Greeks and their culture than we do. The contribution of the Greeks to Western philosophy may have been philosophy itself, as Bernard Williams remarked, but without men like Lucretius and Cicero and Seneca taking the trouble to learn Greek and study the literature firsthand, little would have survived. And that is true of so many other aspects of Greek culture. Gamma, third. By building on the accomplishments and ideas of Alexander the Great, the Romans created a world in which ideas could travel freely and where men and women could, for the most part, live in peace. This was also a considerable achievement. Though most people today rank the Greeks as immeasurably greater artists and dramatists than the Romans, there are many things that the Romans achieved unaided. Roman law, for instance, eventually codified by Justinian, is one of their greatest legacies to the West. It's all too easy to regard the Greeks as sensitive aesthetes and the Romans as coarse-grained technocrats, but the truth is far more complex. Another thing the Romans gave the Greeks, we could argue, though this is somewhat problematic as an issue, is employment. Employment for highly talented physicians, teachers, entertainers, and the like. It's problematic because much of this employment was servile employment, by which I mean that the Greeks were, in many cases, slaves. They might have been highly regarded as experts in their fields, as teachers, for instance, but they were slaves nonetheless, though later many of them became freedmen. A fourth answer to the so what question has to do with the impact of Greek and Roman culture on other cultures. We've emphasized the vitality, endurance, and creativity of what went on under the title Greco-Roman, but it's absolutely vital to appreciate that the Romans weren't the only ancient people who fell under the spell of Greek culture. There were many other Mediterranean peoples who did so as well. To begin with, did the Etruscans, the people of Etruria, who lived to the north of Rome and whose culture was considerably older than the Romans. So too did all the parts of the world that became incorporated into the empire of Alexander the Great. A large area in the Middle East, including parts of Mesopotamia, even Afghanistan and India. So too did the Jews, whose culture and tradition were as strong as any. They felt its power and its attraction, as we saw in a previous lecture when we talked about the widespread phenomenon of Hellenized Jewry. And so too, from the 8th century AD onwards, did the Muslims, who fell under the power of Greek philosophy and science, with the result that many works were translated into Arabic, particularly those of Aristotle. I don't mean to imply that Greece was in some magical way better than all of these other cultures, or that its achievements were superior to all others, or than a host of other cultures that didn't come into Greece's cultural orbit. And of course, Rome's influence on the Mediterranean and beyond was profound as well. I'm not in the business of idolizing the Greeks, or indeed the Romans for that matter. Even so, it's a pretty impressive track record of influence. The fifth answer relates to history after the period covered by this course. We've seen the Latin West shrink and disintegrate, whereas the Greek East continued to evolve and develop. We've seen how the Latin West and the Greek East went their separate ways, under separate governments and facing separate political, military, economic and social challenges. And we've seen, too, how the East continued to maintain a political toehold over Italy, right down into the 7th century. And though this is boiling a complex story down to its lowest common denominator, if there was an eventual winner, one would probably have to say that it was the Byzantine Empire established in the Greek-speaking East. That's because it was the Greek East that retained its unity, that remained a military force to reckon with, and that upheld the value system of the once mighty Roman Empire with its emphasis upon ethnic pluralism. And not for nothing, its inhabitants identified themselves as Romaioi. But though the two sides now had separate political identities, in the cultural and affective sense, they remained in the mindset of others that unique Greco-Roman entity. And such has been the case, not least in the European imagination, down to the present day. So my fifth answer to the so what question has to do with the antithesis between Greece and Rome, which really has had a very good run for its money. When I first got interested in Greece and Rome, two books captured my imagination. John Clark Stobart's The Glory That Was Greece and The Grandeur That Was Rome. The titles, incidentally, come from lines in a poem by Edgar Allan Poe. The books were written in 1911 and 1913, respectively. I don't imagine that they're widely read much today. They weren't much when I was at school. But the general distinction implied in the titles and the woolly romanticism that underpins it is certainly still in currency, though I've never been able to work out exactly what differentiates glory from grandeur, all the more so since glory is a quintessentially Roman word associated with a military triumph. In an introduction, Stobart writes, "Athens and Rome stand side by side as the parents of Western civilization. The parental metaphor," he continues, "is almost irresistible. Rome is obviously masculine and robust, Greece endowed with so much loveliness and grace. Rome subjugates by physical conquest and government. Greece yields so easily to the Roman might, and in revenge so easily dominates Rome itself with all that Rome has conquered by the mere attractiveness of superior humanity." Stobart doesn't quite go so far as to describe Greece as womanly, but he comes perilously close. What else is loveliness and grace? He then remembers, just in time, that the Greeks did rather well at repulsing the Persians, and also that Alexander the Great was a pretty plucky little chap as well, so he backs off a bit. Stobart's attempt to resolve the Greeks and the Romans into two different personality types is highly revealing, even though the suggestion that they could be characterized as masculine and feminine seems today somewhat comical, even perhaps faintly offensive. In fact, the integration and opposition of Greek and Roman identity cannot be conveniently boxed in any kind of reductionist way. The Greco-Roman synthesis, like it or not, is all around us. Although the moment we start talking about the legacy of that unique cultural conjunction, then we need another course of 36 lectures or more. In fact, much of our course has been about reception history, since it was the Roman reception of the Greeks that constitutes one of the earliest links in the long chain of reception that we call Western civilization. Greco-Roman, that unique conjunction. There's never been anything quite like it. Two cultures perpetually joined at the hip, and at the same time, two cultures in perpetual opposition. The Greeks were outward-going, idealistic, inventive, sophisticated, curious, and endemically prone to rivalry, whereas the Romans were inherently conservative, highly disciplined, prone to moralizing, practical, suspicious of intellectuals, and goal-driven. But, and it is a big but, that would be to fall into the trap of psychoanalyzing them and of stereotyping them in reductionist, oppositional terms, as Stobart did. Well, the fact is that the two cultures have often provided an oppositional point of reference in the minds of those individuals and cultures that have fallen under their spell. And it is to this topic that I now want to turn by looking at modern history. In Germany in the 1770s, two highly influential thinkers, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and Johann Joachim Winckelmann, spearheaded a movement that projected Germany as the living embodiment of the Hellenic spirit. Goethe was a playwright and philosopher, Winckelmann an art historian. The only way for us to become great, indeed inimitable, if this is possible, is to imitate the ancients, Goethe wrote. And for ancients here, read Greeks. And what exactly was that Hellenic spirit, according to these highly educated gentlemen? It was all that is natural, beautiful, spiritual, rational, and human. The thesis that the Germans were the heirs to Hellenic culture gained currency at the time when the French Revolution broke out in 1789. And that's because the French, who opposed Germany's rise to power in Europe, identified themselves with Rome, not primarily imperial Rome, but rather Rome of the early Republic. Think of the paintings by Jacques-Louis David. The lictors bring to Brutus the bodies of his sons, 1789. Marcus Junius Brutus, you'll recall, overthrew the Roman monarchy in a manner that could be seen by the leaders of the French Revolution as anticipating their overthrow of the French monarchy. In David's painting, we see Brutus looking away from the bodies. As a good Republican, he does not show any grief because they have been justly killed for having joined in a plot to restore the monarchy. Another famous picture of David's that is expressive of Republican ideals is the Oath of the Horatii, 1785. And here we see three brothers, the Horatii, taking an oath before their father to fight to the death in defense of Rome. France's attachment to Roman Republican values lasted intermittently through the 19th century and indeed down to the present day. And Germany, too, celebrated its attachment to the Greek spirit for well over a century. It was, in part, a political convenience, given Germany's continuing troubled relationship with France, culminating in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 1871. Not unconnectedly, perhaps, it was a German, the 17-year-old Bavarian crown prince Otto von Wittelsbach, who was chosen by the European powers to be the first king of the newly created Kingdom of Greece after the Greek War of Independence came to an end in 1832. Carl Friedrich Schinkel, arguably the greatest German architect of his day, even drew up plans for a royal palace to be integrated into the ruins of the Acropolis. But there was more to it than just that. In 1872, the young philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche published The Birth of Tragedy, in which he claimed that Germany was experiencing the main epochs of Greek history in reverse order. In other words, Germany was moving back from the somewhat decadent, mannered, and imitative Hellenistic era to the much more robust, elevated, and optimistic classical era that had preceded it. An interesting hypothesis. Such was Germany's fascination with Greece that E.M. Butler talked of the tyranny of Greece over Germany. When Berlin became the capital of a united Germany in 1871, it described itself as Athens on the Spree being the river that runs through the city. Carl Friedrich Schinkel designed the Altes Museum, the museum that houses antiquities, including the Great Altar of Pergamum. In the neoclassical style that is inspired by Greek architecture and incidentally that around the same time was being used to establish Athens as a European capital. In British history, parallels have been made both with Greece and with Rome. The Greek War of Independence inspired an outpouring of Philhellenism in which leading romantics saw themselves almost as latter-day classical Greeks. The greatest English Philhellene of all was the romantic poet Lord Byron, who penned the line, "I dream that Greece might yet be free," and who was so enamoured of the call for Greek liberty from Ottoman rule that he died in its cause, although not on the battlefield as he had intended, but from sickness in the swamps of Missolonghi. Then, not long afterwards, in 1850, an incident occurred that caused the British to see themselves in the role of the Romans. A Portuguese Jew named Don Pacifico, who was a British subject, had his house in Athens burned down in an anti-Semitic riot. After failing to get satisfaction from the Greek government, the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Palmerston, sent gunboats to Greece. Palmerston's action, or rather his overreaction, caused deep offence internationally, and he was censured in the House of Lords. He subsequently defended his action in the House of Commons, however, declaring that the matter before the House was whether, as in former days, a Roman could say, "Civis Romanus sum," I am a Roman citizen, and thus be free of all indignity. A British subject, in whatever land he may be, shall also feel confident, he said, that the watchful eye and strong arm of England will protect him against injustice and wrong. Palmerston was, in effect, replaying the entire political dynamic that we've seen in this course. His comparison between Rome and the British Empire was not unique in this period either, as Lord Robert Cecil later observed. Whatever folly or madness an English government may commit, the appeal to Civis Romanus doctrine is rarely without effect upon an English audience. Pundits today regularly draw parallels between America and Rome. Like Rome, America is the only superpower in the world, yet one which is stretched beyond its resources. Like Rome, America's wealth is arguably leading to decadence. And old Europe, isn't that the contentious and cantankerous Greeks who just couldn't get their act together and were always burying their heads in the sand? So Greece and Rome still provide symbolic pegs of reference on which to hang a lot of polarizing argumentation. But they also do so much more besides. I'd like to emphasize the degree to which the study of Greek and Roman history is not frozen in time. One of the most exciting things about Greek and Roman history is the degree to which our knowledge of both is rapidly changing. People sometimes think that it's a static subject consisting of beautiful statues, crumbling buildings, and world-class texts, all of which have been around for centuries. But it's not like that at all. New information is being added daily, and new methodologies are being implemented to interpret it. There are, of course, some classic works like Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire and George Grote's A History of Greece. But most books on ancient history written more than 50 years ago about Greek or Roman history just aren't worth reading today. So much has changed in our thinking as well as in our knowledge. Ancient historians constantly face the possibility that something may be discovered tomorrow that will radically transform their understanding of Greek or Roman history, requiring them perhaps to revise even their most basic assumptions. So the study of ancient history, like the study of all history, is in fact invariably provisional. So, the conclusion to end all conclusions, at least for this course. We've undertaken an epic journey in history, an integrated history covering 1,500 years, which I have attempted to recount with both imagination and objectivity. But we've also discovered in the course of it what we have inherited from our Mediterranean and, more recently, I would add, from our Eurasian forebears. The integrated history of Greece and Rome is the story of two cultures in continuous contact. As I said at the beginning of this course, I believe we need both the Greeks and the Romans in order to help us to make sense of who we are and how we arrived here. I believe it even more as we come to the end. But the understanding of Greece and Rome is also about the forging of our collective Western self. I profoundly believe that Greece and Rome are inside us, both as destructive and as creative forces. They have shaped our ethics and aesthetics, our science, religion and politics, our language, literature and law, and so much more besides. They've taught us our ways of being a human being and of seeing the world. We are their heirs and their guardians, a heavy but invigorating charge.